From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Certainly on our radar is shares of Block, because we have seen them take a major hit as a result of some research out by Hindenburg. You remember, that's the firm run by Nathan Anderson, bolstered its profile with that scathing report on billionaire Gautam Adani's business empire earlier this year that really took down that name. Well, right now, he and their team has set their sights on Block. They did a two-year investigation, and just about 1.5 hours ago, Block fought back a little bit. So let's get into it with our own Bloomberg News finance reporter, Kat Dougherty. She's here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio, joining myself and Mike Regan. And I just want to check, shares of Block are down still about 16% off their lows, but still taking a hit. All right, Kat, what first of all did the Hindenburg research say? And I know it's out on social media, so people can read it as well, but what were the highlights?
The low lights that they're alleging is that this company took advantage and facilitated essentially the fraudsters who were then using government stimulus programs during the pandemic and essentially allowing folks to have multiple accounts. So even if an account, the report would say, had been flagged as fraud, that account was then tied to multiple other accounts and it wasn't dealt with in a proper way. So essentially, I think that was the key here, is the extent to which the fraudsters could actually take advantage of the system. And so this report goes further into saying that they manipulated certain numbers, and that they either didn't go far enough to say how many of these accounts were fraud, or that they understated, especially the customer acquisitions as well.
So that obviously, if true, it would have inflated Block's business, correct? The metrics then would be off, the financial metrics.
Correct. So then Block came out and said that these claims were inaccurate and misleading. They're saying, we are registered with the SEC. We report factual, accurate information, and that the report that we saw from Hindenburg manipulated information, and it was not an accurate depiction of what's actually going on.
You know, Kat, I think when I think of Block, I think of the sort of point of sale, use a tablet, iPad or whatever to swipe your credit card at a small store or something like that. This seems to center on a different Block product, the Cash App. Is that basically the gist of it, that most of this fraud that Hindenburg is alleging was using the Cash App?
A big part of it in the report does seem to be that this Cash App was likely facilitating fraudsters taking advantage again of that government stimulus program. And in response, the state of Massachusetts, this is something that was referenced, told the short seller, so this report, that it sought to claw back close to 70,000 unemployment payments from the bank behind Cash App accounts. That's something that is referred to in this report. So again, we'll see what the company actually comes back, and they said that they're going to take some legal action, and they probably will have further statements to provide. Right. But this was a report that was facilitated or underwent for 2 years.
I just want to reiterate. So the research from Hindenburg says Block has widely overstated its genuine user counts and has understated its customer acquisition costs. Former employees estimated that 40 to 75% of accounts they reviewed were fake, involved in fraud, or were additional accounts tied to a single individual. If that is the case, and I'm curious, as you guys are reporting this out, looking at Block and looking at its balance sheet, how would that materially, financially change the story of Block?
Well, I think the first thing to look at is regulatory response. So this is going to be, this is already a regulated company, but it's going to be scrutinized, and the report is going to be cross-checked, I'm sure, with the public information that's out there. So that's the first thing that I think is going to be the next course of action. Mm-hmm. And then as information starts to come out, either a company may clarify certain things or who knows, parts of this report could be corroborated, and in which case, if things are proven true, well, then we have other problems, or the company has further problems and answers that they need to
give.
But
if, I guess my case is like, Mike, I think if that's the case, if that's true, right, it's a very different in terms of how you value the company, how you look at the growth in the business,
right,
or lack thereof.
Do they need to restate earnings, or, you know, is it really facing a big fine and punitive damages that has everyone concerned in the stock price? But Kat, you know, one thing I think is interesting is they're not the only company who's had to deal with fraud claims when it comes to the government stimulus payments. Other banks have too, right? Is it just that Block is way, at least according to Hindenburg, just way out there as far as how many they allowed happen?
I don't know the exact comparison in terms of numbers. I do know that there have been other banks that were caught in, it was like credit card payments when the government was giving out stimulus on the form of what was essentially debit cards, and those were manipulated in ways where people were taking more debit cards than they actually were allowed. So that's another case. I think this is very different, it sounds. I'm not exactly sure how the app, it seems like how the app was used was just adding more accounts, and so you had one person, but they're taking advantage and using multiple accounts, so they're therefore getting more stimulus when they're only supposed to be allowed to use one account.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You do have the analyst community, you know, starting to weigh in. Certainly Raymond James came out earlier today contending that the report and the short by Hindenburg doesn't include a lot of new, in quotation marks, news or a bombshell, and argues that the biggest risk is potentially drawing scrutiny from regulators and politicians, which would create some overhang on the stock. Right now, you've got 41 buys on Block, 10 holds and 2 sells. So, you know, Wall Street, for the most part, likes this. I was curious, and forgive me if this is out of your purview, but when I think about short sellers, we're always so careful, right, when we bring up a short seller, and we always want to make sure we get a comment from the company. But having said that, what are the laws, rules, if you will, if any, when it comes to somebody coming out with a blockbuster report like Hindenburg and being such a short on the company? What are their responsibilities?
We've seen a number of reports from Hindenburg, most notably recently Adani.
Right.
And we saw Clover Health. And these reports, they are allowed. It's not as if once these reports come out, then they
just
get in
the
trouble
flip side
for,
to a
for
trade,
putting out.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. It's as if another analyst is putting out, it's commentary, and it's you could even put out a tweet. Now that's going to be scrutinized in a different way, I think. This report actually, I believe, did come through a tweet, which is... Through social media. And I know that that's been circulated, and there's been a lot of responses since then. But I do think that the big question is the regulatory scrutiny of the company here. The report is what it is, and it'll be used and looked at, but some of the fundamental questions, or I guess fundamental aspects of the company that the report is pointing out, they may be looked at in a different way just right. because of what they started to explore.
And it's, you know, it's interesting because not every activist short seller report is met with this type of reaction
right.
in the stock market, which kind of speaks to the reputation Hindenburg has. What can you tell us about sort of their track record with this type of thing? It seems to me like they're pretty good at knocking share prices down and leaving them down for a long time.
Yes, especially immediately. I mean, the shares today of Block were down 22%. They've since recovered a little bit, especially since the company responded, put out its own statement. But Adani, Clover Health, those were some of the big ones that at least I was tracking. They've recovered the six-month period. Some of these stocks, they lost significant market valuation and then have, after a half of a year, gone back to before to where they were before the reports came out. So it really depends on the name, and I think to the extent of what is included in the report, how damning it actually is. And then also, if there's any information that comes out even after the report, either to prove it false or true.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking at. I mean, the stock, I mean, Block could do no wrong for such a long time, and Wall Street loved it, right? And then it's down, I think, about 75% since August of, I think, going back to 2021. I mean, it's way down a lot.
One of those high-growth fintechs that
it was a pandemic darling.
Yeah.
It really was.
Right? And none of them are performing too well in this environment, but... you don't see that kind of instant knee-jerk reaction very often. It's pretty dramatic.
Well, I guess stay tuned, right, and just see kind of what the next step is. The stock, though, shares of Block still down about 16% here off their lows of the day, but nonetheless a pretty significant hit. Kat, thank you so much. Glad you could come in and just kind of lay it out for us. Kat Dougherty, finance reporter at Bloomberg News here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
We want to talk a little bit about something Bloomberg News gave you a heads up on yesterday, and that is the Ford Motor Company. We're getting more clarity, more specifics. The company predicting losses in its EV business, electric vehicle business, will grow to $3 billion this year as it spends big on new models and factories. The deficit matching its accumulated EV losses over the past 2 years. The stock right now a little bit lower, though we did see a little bit higher earlier in today's session. So let's get to it with Bloomberg News auto reporter Keith Naughton. He's with us following this via Zoom in Detroit. So Keith, $3 billion sounds like a lot. You were giving us a heads up on it yesterday. Why the losses, and put it in perspective?
Well, what Ford says, Carol, is that the EV business is like a startup inside Ford Motor Company. And like any startup, they incur a lot of losses as they spend for future growth. So what that spending is they are currently working on their second generation of electric vehicles. You know, they already have the electric F-150 Lightning pickup truck out there and the Mustang Mach-E. So now they're working on the second generation of electric vehicles, which will be ground up and cost a lot of money. And they are on a building spree. They're building their first new assembly plant in 50 years in Tennessee to build electric F-Series trucks. And they're building battery factories in Tennessee, Kentucky, and Michigan. So they've got a lot of factory construction going on, and they've got a lot of spending on new models.
You know, Keith, it seems to have caught the market at least somewhat by surprise that the loss would be this big. Correct me if I'm wrong about that, but what is the story there? Is just that this spending, these investments they're making are a lot bigger than what they projected, or at least what analysts were penciling in?
You know, Ford has said that they're planning to spend $50 billion in total on electric vehicles by 2026. The plan is to ramp up their factory production to be producing 2 million vehicles a year by the end of 2026. Last year, they sold about 65,000 in America. So it's a very steep ramp and a very big spend because, you know, they don't want to be left behind in this transition to electric vehicles, and they're trying to catch Tesla. The losses are rising, not going down. They had a $900 million loss in 21. They had a $2.1 billion loss on EVs last year, and then it'll be up 43% this year to that $3 billion figure we're talking about. So they're in this heavy investment period, but they say they will be profitable on an earnings before interest and taxes basis by the end of 2026. They'll have an 8% EBIT margin, they say, on EVs.
Hey, Keith, help me out, though. Like, to Mike's point, and, you know, the stock earlier, Ford was up 2.6% earlier in the session before it moved a little bit lower. And I guess you've covered this inside and out, and I feel like the Wall Street community who covers Ford gets what they have to do. I get this concept of a startup within, you know, a bigger, broader company. Is the Street to some extent kind of comfortable with it? I'm not seeing any analyst calls come out, any downgrades, at least not yet, or any kind of move. So the Street aware that this is what it's going to take for this transition?
Yeah, Carol, actually the $3 billion loss, which sounds awful, I understand, is not as bad as some analysts were projecting. There were projections out there of they thought Ford lost $6 billion last year on electric vehicles. So while $3 billion is bad, maybe not as bad as the market expected. The stock was up as much as 2% in the morning. During the morning, also, Ford CFO John Lawler was doing this teach-in at the NYSE with analysts. So You know, they were trying to explain this walk to profitability. I was listening in. The analysts seemed fairly skeptical that they could get to there from here. It's a big walk. Last year's EBIT margin on electric vehicles is negative 40%.
Ouch.
They say by the end of 26, we'll be at positive 8%. That's a lot. So analysts were skeptical, probably rightly so.
You know, Keith, as a Twitter addict over here, you know, it's hard not to notice the distraction Elon Musk has undertaken with his purchase of Twitter, and getting very political on that on the site itself, turning a lot of people off with some of his political opinions and culture war type of opinions. So I'm wondering, like, what is the lane, do you think, and the strategy at Ford to actually take some share from Tesla? Does Musk's personality play into it at all, or is it just a matter of they want to make cheaper cars, better cars? What's their strategy entail for getting that share away from Tesla?
Right. So, I mean, Ford's strategy is they are going straight for the mainstream. You know, where Teslas sell best is on the coasts, right? They kind of sell to the converted, if you will, folks who are wealthy and are inclined to take actions to either because of climate change or because that's you know, that's what is the current, you know, going trend, and they have the money to afford that. Ford's going for the big middle in America that buy pickup trucks and buy Mustangs. The things that Ford is electrifying are these sort of classic names that have been popular in middle America for years. And so far, they're off to a very strong start. You know, the F-150 Lightning plug-in pickup truck had 200,000 reservations when it went on sale last April. And they are doubling the capacity right now at the Mexican factory that builds the Mustang Mach-E. That'll be able to produce 210,000 models a year by the end of this year. And you know, last year they produced fewer than 100,000. So it's working so far, but it's very early days for Ford. They are the second best seller of electric vehicles in America, but they're miles behind Tesla, which controls 2/3 of the EV market in America.
You know, I keep wondering, you know, Keith, in terms of a company like a Ford or a General Motors that still, thank God, they have internal combustion engine vehicles, right? Because they still make a lot of money off of that, right? And that's kind of the flip side. But having said that, I wonder how much of that is a drag, you know, in terms of really being out there with EVs, right? Elon Musk is a pure play doing it differently. And I just wonder if that longer term is a going to be a problem for Ford or GM or not?
I mean, Ford and GM, but Ford is saying that, you know, internal combustion engine vehicles are still a growth business for them. Mm-hmm. They sell lots of Bronco SUVs. They sell, you know, like 900,000 F-Series trucks every year. It's the best-selling vehicle in America since the first Reagan administration.
Wow.
So there's a huge, I mean, you have to keep in mind that electric vehicles make up 5.8% of the U.S. market. So every 9.5 vehicles sold is still a gas-fueled car or truck.
And is the F-150 Lightning, the actual performance of that vehicle, enough to convert the type of people that already own the gas-powered pickup truck?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question because, you know, those folks wouldn't seem to be they sell mostly in red states. They wouldn't seem to necessarily be folks who are, you know, trying to address climate change in their vehicle purchases. But, you know, what the Lightning has done, its popularity is actually with newcomers to Ford and newcomers to pickup trucks. Ford says, you know, more than 60% of the sales of the Lightning go to these newbies, not to the traditional truckers. But eventually, if you're going to convert the fleet, the best-selling vehicles in America are the Ford truck, the GM truck, and the, you know, Ram truck. That's what Americans buy. And so if you're going to electrify the vehicle fleet in this country, you have to be successful in electrifying pickup trucks, which is, of course, why Elon Musk is doing the Cybertruck.
It's so interesting in terms of all that's going on.
I forgot about the Cybertruck.
How could you forget about the Cybertruck? That's because we're waiting, right?
Exactly.
All right, Keith Naughton, good stuff. Auto reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us via Zoom from Detroit.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Joining Mike and myself, Bloomberg News technology reporter Alex Borinka, joining us right now. She's been up on Capitol Hill. So, all right, Alex, first of all, a lot to get to. Tell us about the mood in the room, how packed it was. Paint the picture for us.
Carol, it was packed to the brim. Folks were overflowing. We were jockeying for seats, even as credentialed media. And sitting right behind TikTok was also kind of a slew of creators. All of these folks got to witness what I would say is probably one of the more contentious congressional hearings that we heard. There was a lot of cutting off of the CEO when he was trying to give answers, a lot of pushing to try to get him to commit to these yes or no questions. Do you have any relationship with the Chinese Communist Party? Who is prepping you today for today? Was there anyone from China in doing so? There was also a lot of emotion, both when it came to the protection of U.S. American users' data, which those national security concerns have been top of mind. But there was also some really kind of emotional moments talking about the impact that social media can have on teens, particularly around users who are posting about suicide on the app. So very high stakes moment and a lot of tension in that room between the CEO and the lawmakers who were not holding back in firing questions his way.
You know, Alex, I'd love to unpack a little bit that notion of the personal data. You know, that seems to be one of the main linchpins here that angers politicians about TikTok is all this personal data. I got to say, I've got three teenage daughters who were all TikTok addicts. I don't know what data they have that the communist China would be interested in, but obviously that's probably not what's worrying people. What is the type of data that's so precious and so dangerous to leak from TikTok into China?
So today we heard folks talk about IP addresses, which is kind of could narrow down your location, GPS data, and that additional location data. And then you had some questions from TikTok CEO Shou-Chu himself saying, what else should I be kind of helping protect U.S. user data for? You asked this question, Michael, and it's one that a lot of folks have talked about in context of TikTok, there being national security concerns about data. The company feels like they are doing as much as they can to protect American users' data. They would argue more than any of their peers by basically setting up this firewall with Oracle to bring all Americans' data onto U.S. soil. You saw him push back today in the very few times that he did push back, basically saying some of these concerns that you guys are alleging, they're hypotheticals. If you give us more specific information, we can kind of work for that. So, you know, young folks might say TikTok and everyone under the sun has my information. But when that argument came up today in the hearing, lawmakers pushed back and said, well, we're not here to talk about everyone else. We're here to talk about TikTok.
Well, there is something to be said to, like, can't the government, like, we work for a company where we have to secure our information. A lot of companies do. I mean, can't the government institutions basically kind of create firewalls around these applications and maybe, you know, not allow employees to use it? And that's a way of kind of protecting themselves?
Absolutely. And federal workers cannot actually use TikTok on their phones after that legislation passed. But we heard something along those lines of kind of comprehensive legislation around data policy be brought up today. Honestly, that was the argument that CEO Shou-Chu was trying to push to broaden this conversation outside of just TikTok. We did hear a little bit of that. Not that they were friendly voices, but voices along the lines of comprehensive legislation from both sides, from Greg Pence on the Republican Republican side, from Darren Soto on the Democratic side, who both kind of echoed this idea that there should be kind of bipartisan legislation that looks at all tech companies. Pence actually came out and said, hey, this is my 32nd hearing that I've been in about tech companies and data. So the push is there, but the problem is TikTok is being seen as kind of a bigger threat right now. And all of those things, those concerns that swirl around regular social media companies, what data do they collect? What are they showing me? Who is influencing me? Where do the ads come from? All of those concerns have been made kind of way more sinister because of this kind of ratcheted up fear of China and those hypotheticals of what could they do if they got your information.
You know, Alex, it's such a sort of perilous political topic because it does seem like there's bipartisan support to do something about TikTok. But on the other hand, no one wants to lose those, you know, millennial Gen Z voters who are addicted to the app. And I know from your coverage and elsewhere, there's several competing bills floating around Washington about what to do. Do you have any sense of where that's going? Is there one piece of legislation that you think has a better chance or is gaining more support than the others?
So the bill from Thune and Warner, which has backing by the Biden administration actually said, send that to Joe's desk and we will kind of make some moves on it. That seems to be the one on pole position. I'll tell you, the representatives in the room at the hearing were not the only ones who are kind of piling on to the anti-TikTok sentiment today. We have messages in our inbox from those senators on that bill who are excited to see the bipartisan kind of flogging that TikTok had to take today in that hearing room, saying, hey, we should push this bill. So those folks are moving forward. They largely say that these national security concerns, these concerns around China, are more important than the 150 million people who enjoy, you know, interesting videos on the app. The voters, you know, I talked to some creators that TikTok brought down here, about half a dozen of them. I asked all of them, have you talked to your representative? Have you talked to your senator? If they vote against TikTok, will you vote for them? Unequivocally, all of them said, my vote would be up for question for those individuals if they pass a bill that bans the app and removes it from my phone here in the U.S.
Alex, if this was a German company, a Japanese company, pick your country other than China, would we be going through this process? Would the CEO of a non-Chinese TikTok be going through this?
China seems to be kind of the focus right now. I mean, last night, just across the lawn from the Hill was a group of VCs and lawmakers meeting at a private dinner where Peter Thiel, the billionaire and venture capitalist, was talking about the risks of China, calling TikTok, likening it to the homeless problem, as he called it here in the U.S., something that we cannot get away from. So that kind of rhetoric has ratcheted up and ratcheted up around this country in particular. You've also seen it with the chip deliberations in the semiconductor industry. So this seems to be kind of the focus right now, and we're not hearing it about those other countries. So China seems to be kind of number one on that list.
20 seconds. Now what? Now what happens?
Now what happens is the company will probably be jockeying to get this legislation off the table. I don't think that's going to happen. We saw such an uproar today. It seems like they lost ground on their argument to garner trust from the U.S. government. So we'll be kind of watching and waiting for next steps on bills and any additional national security review as a result from the testimony today.
All right. Well, some great coverage and reporting. Alex, thanks so much. Alex Barinka, technology reporter at Bloomberg News there, I believe in our D.C. bureau, after spending time up on the Hill listening and watching that testimony.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
A Bloomberg Law team noted about a year ago that drug makers advertise drugs through TV and other media to encourage patients to ask their doctors for specific medications. In that story, our reporter citing a GAO report on how manufacturers spent about $6 billion each year for a total of $17.8 billion on direct-to-consumer advertising for more than 550 drugs from 2016 to 2018. They spend a lot. That's the bottom line. So looking at pharma advertising, a new study led by researchers at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Joining us right now to talk about it is Gerard Anderson, professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the school, of course, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. He joins us now via Zoom in Washington, D.C. Gerard, nice to have you here with us. Tell us about this study, what you looked at, and what you found out.
Sure, it's good to be back. So there are only two countries in the world that allow direct-to-consumer advertising, the United States and New Zealand. And so what we wanted to understand is why are they doing this and what's so important? And as you said in your introduction, many of us watch it on television, and my wife and I were watching it on television, and I would look at them and I'd say, why are they spending so much money on advertising? And what it, if you looked at the fine print on TV or something like that, you'd see that many of these drugs really don't work very well. They do a little bit better than nothing, but they don't work very well. So we wanted to take a look at whether or not they actually are very good compared to the drugs that are other ones that are also being provided. And it turns out that most of them are not. And it sort of makes sense. They're going to go to the consumer when they can't go to the physician, because the physician knows that the drug isn't particularly good or is equally good but much more expensive, and so it's not going to prescribe it. So you go directly to the consumer and you say to them, go ask your doctor. And the doctors hate this because they know that the drug is either much more expensive and therefore not good for the patient, or not as good or just as good as another drug. So we basically published a paper that said, be cautious when you watch an advertisement.
Well, right, Jerry, because it seems like it must work, right? They wouldn't be spending this type of dollars if it wasn't working. So are some doctors able to be convinced, I guess, or is it that some patients, you know, maybe I'm a hypochondriac. Sometimes I'm watching the commercials and I'm like, restless legs? Do I have restless legs?
We all do.
You know, how does this work that the doctors actually end up prescribing the drugs that patients are seeing on TV?
So you got to understand how much these drugs cost. Some of these drugs are $10,000. Some of these drugs are $50,000. Some of these are drugs are more than $100,000 or more. So if you just get a few patients watching this ad, going to the doctor and saying, you should, you know, prescribe this drug for me. And doctors really don't like to disappoint their patients, so they do. So if they can just get a few patients that decide to do this, they've made money on this particular ad. So they're going to do this just because of the high prices of these drugs that are being advertised on TV.
So where are regulators on this? Like, why isn't the FDA in their analysis creating some kind of metric, especially when there's maybe a couple of drugs used for some ailment, and saying this one's more effective, this one's more effective than this one? You know, why isn't that part of it?
Because the FDA is not responsible for doing that. In fact, there's nobody in the United States responsible for making that decision. We have, unlike other industrialized countries where there are entities sponsored by the federal government, sponsored by insurers, sponsored by a variety of things that make those recommendations to people, we in the United States don't have anybody making those recommendations. The FDA says the drug is safe and effective, or efficacious. That's what it says. It doesn't say it's better than another drug, it's more expensive than another drug. It is just saying this drug is safe to take, and that's only the responsibility they have. There's nobody saying, well, you could take this drug, but it's not quite as good, or you could take this drug, but it's three times more expensive. There isn't anybody out there in the United States that essentially is making that recommendation to people.
You know, Jerry, one line popped out at me in this story. It says, since 1996, annual direct-to-consumer advertising budgets for prescription drugs have increased from $1.3 billion to $6 billion in 2016. And I'm thinking back to the 90s when there was a, sort of a lot of scandals, I guess you could call it, about drug reps, you know, who would go and wine and dine doctors and take them golfing or take them on vacations. And there was a big backlash to that and a crackdown on that. Do you think this is sort of the modern version of that? Is this how the drug companies are sort of getting away from that problem and creating a new one?
Well, so they're still allowed to wine and dine the physicians and whatever. They just have to report it. So they're still able to do that. Some places like Johns Hopkins don't allow the pharmaceutical reps into the hospital, but many places do. But what they're saying is, these are very profitable drugs for us. We're going to try everything we can to get another prescription written. And so we'll go to the doctors, but we're also, for these drugs, which are not quite as effective or are much more expensive, we're also going to go to the patient and get them to lobby their own doctor. Well, give me this drug. I've read it on TV. I saw it on TV. I should be taking this drug. Why aren't I taking this drug?
Well, Jerry, what about doctors, though? I mean, doctors, I would assume they take the Hippocratic Oath. They want to do best by their patients. So if they have a buffet of drugs, they're going to go for the one that is going to be, I would assume, best for their patient and do the most. Isn't that kind of the stopgap?
That is the stopgap. But now think of yourself as a doctor. You have a patient comes in and says, I want this drug. And you could sit there and spend 25 minutes explaining to them the science behind the two drugs and why this other drug is better or less expensive. Or you could just say, okay, I'll give you the drug that you want. It's going to cost you more. It has less effectiveness, but if you want it, I'm going to give it to you. I mean, it's the same as, you know, we talk about obesity and, you know, the doctor should talk to us about obesity and a whole variety of other things, but it would take a long time and you might alienate some patients. And some patients would say, well, if this doctor doesn't want to give it to me, I'm going to go to another doctor.
But don't insurance companies too kind of weigh in? Like I've seen situations like, hey, you can use the generic.
Yeah.
Like, don't they play a role here?
They do play a role. It's called prior authorization. And what they say is, you know, you've got to try this drug before you take this drug. Mm. And so they're making it hard to get the more expensive or the less effective drug. But still, the doctors lobby, in some cases, the insurance companies. And in most cases, the insurance companies end up giving up and saying, oh, okay, you know this patient better than we do. And, you know, you've now called me three times and bugged me for this patient. And therefore, you know, yes, we'll give you that new and expensive drug. You just get lobbied enough as an insurance company. You don't want to be known as the insurance company that always says no.
Do we all have restless leg syndrome? That's what we really want to know. Mike's convinced we all have it. Jerry, no, I think it's an important situation because you're right. We all see the ads. They're often out there big time. And it's interesting that we've got to be smart and not be sold to. What?
Interesting point this story makes, too, is that the U.S. doesn't have a comparative effectiveness rating like other countries do. And that sounds like maybe that's an issue that the U.S.
I'd
needs
love
to
a
get
rating.
On board with.
I'd love a rating. I'm looking at something and saying,
is this thing really worth it?
Yeah, exactly. I think it would be really smart. And it would be a lot more transparent, if you will. Jerry, thank you so much. Jerry Anderson, professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at Johns Hopkins, Bloomberg School of Public Health, joining us from Washington.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving, stay in prison.
It's the question that drives us.
Keep driving crazy.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, just got about 17 and a half minutes left in today's trading session. We're just bouncing off our lows of the session when it comes to the equity trade, but we're well off our highs of the day. Bank stocks still seeing some pressure. Looking at the Spider S&P Regional Banking Index, it is still down about 3% in the trade. And Mike, we've got that two-year note with a yield of 3.78, so staying well below that 4% mark. We were up there, I think, earlier in the session.
Yeah, absolutely. And anytime you see those lower yields, it signals a few things. I mean, are people worried about growth? Is it they think the Fed's done? But the best you can say is it does perhaps alleviate a little bit of the banking stress that we've seen, especially the further out the curve you go. You know, those mark-to-market were not losses on banks' bonds.
So, right?
Yeah, I think everyone's happy to see a drop in yields these days.
All right. Well, let's see what our next guest has to say about all of this. Time for our Drive to the Close guest, Amanda Agati. She's back with us, Chief Investment Officer at PNC Asset Management. She is with us today on the phone in Philadelphia. Amanda, good to have you back with us. It's been an interesting 24 hours. The Fed decision, the continuing bank questions and nervousness, the dialing back, it feels like, from Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen when it comes to maybe backstopping bank deposits. How has any of it, if at all, changed your thinking about investment strategy, the right strategy in today's environment?
Well, thank you so much for having me. There's a ton to unpack. We could be on the line together all day going through all of those variables, a lot of competing narratives. I would say at the end of the day, it hasn't really changed our approach to investment strategy or portfolio positioning. We've been running a defensive playbook for the last few months here, trying to keep our investors invested, not pulling the ripcord and raising a ton of cash here, staying well-diversified, focusing on quality. I'm not sure that anything over the last 24 hours has changed that dynamic at all, but certainly the end state for monetary policy is becoming a lot clearer and probably sooner than what the market has expected. So that's driven a lot of market leadership and rotation. The flip side of that is, you know, is there another shoe to drop? What are the signs of stress that are building here? And so I think this is the arm wrestling match that the market's just going to continue to face here. And it's sort of leading to overall kind of a directionless market, but under the surface, clearly a lot of volatility.
You know, Amanda, it's interesting. I think the cliche that you hear, that everyone hears on their first day of trading school or investing school, whatever it is don't fight the Fed. But in this case, you know, I wonder which way you shouldn't fight the Fed, because on one hand, they are obviously raising rates. Chair Powell said there's no plans to cut them this year. But on the other side, everyone is fixating on that Fed balance sheet, and the discount window is wide open. The Fed has, you know, flooded the financial system with cash in the last few weeks. So which way, you know, should you not fight the Fed, on the balance sheet side or the interest rate side?
I think it's really more on the interest rate side. You know, if you look at the Fed funds futures market, there's still a disconnect between what the Fed has been saying, what the Fed is actually doing, and what the market thinks the Fed is going to do. And so I think it's much more of a focus there. And don't fight the Fed. I have gone on record many times as fighting the Fed. This is an easy target to critique what they're doing or not doing, but for, you know, the last, call it 6 or 7 months, I've been really trying to stay close to what the Fed signaling effect is and what they're actually doing. I think they remain very much committed, as Powell said yesterday, to fighting this inflationary battle. But obviously, we're starting to see some signs of stress. And so makes total sense for them to slow down here. But I think the market trying to call the Fed's bluff that we're going to see a number of cuts here in the very short run feels kind of delusional.
Banks, is there an entry point for you with the selling that we've seen?
Well, I don't know that I want to necessarily comment too much on the investment thesis around banks or an entry point, but we definitely think that there's a lot of high-quality assets, especially relative to deposits out there. And sure, there's signs of stress building in the system, but on balance, we feel like the industry is in pretty good shape. I mean, of course, we're watching financial conditions tighten here. Fed took a step, you know, further in that direction yesterday. So I'm not saying that we're, you know, out of the woods yet. But, you know, I think on balance, we're in pretty good shape. A lot of people, you know, making a lot of comparisons to the financial crisis. And I hate to say it, but it's a little bit different this time. A lot of controls, a lot of oversight, a lot of stress testing, a lot of really stringent capital and liquidity ratios in place make the industry in a much better shape overall this time around relative to last time.
Conversely, if I may, in terms of, I mean, financials have been on our radar. They are the worst performing major industry group in the S&P 500 over the past 2 weeks. Surprise. But at the top of the list, or the second best performing, is information technology. And the best performing is communication services. We've seen investors moving into some of the big tech names. What's your call on that group?
Well, I would say that group probably has gotten a bit far ahead of itself, you know, but we're not of the opinion that we're going to see meaningful rate cuts here in the short run, and we're certainly not headed back towards a zero interest rate policy dynamic. And so the tailwinds for those areas are not going to be anywhere near what they have been over the last few years. And I think this is just the market trying to quickly claim victory in this battle against inflation and thinking that rates are going to come down a lot. We certainly have seen rates come in and come down a lot here in the last couple of weeks. And so I think it's just simply that. I don't know that it's a formula kind of rates come down, growth stocks, the discount rate associated with them should be improving. But I'm not sure that the fundamental backdrop justifies how far growth exposures have rallied year to date.
You know, Amanda, Fed Chair Powell obviously likes to talk about the long and variable effects of raising interest rates. Obviously, we've seen that crop up very suddenly with the stress in the banking sector. Commercial real estate's seen better days. Where else would you be looking to see some stress build up because of this aggressive rate campaign we've seen?
Amanda, just got about 25 seconds. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's really hard to answer that, but I think there is probably broader stress underneath the surface there in terms of balance sheet management across the market spectrum and across the market capitalization spectrum. So I'd be a little concerned about smaller and mid exposures in this environment.
Well, good to check in with you. Really appreciate it. Again, Amanda Agati, she's Chief Investment Officer at PNC Asset Management, on the phone from Philadelphia.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.